By the end of the war, the balding, broad-faced Berrier, with his swollen, moist lips and the cloudy brown eyes, was ugly, flabby, and unhealthy-looking with a greyish-yellow complexion. The life of a Stalinist magnate was not a healthy one. No one worked harder than the inhumanly energetic Berrier, but he still played volleyball every weekend with his wife Nina and his team of bodyguards. Despite his mountainous workload, Berrier found time for a Draculean sex life that combined love, rape, and perversity in almost equal measure. The war had given him the opportunity to engage in a life of sexual brigandage, even more intense and reckless than that enjoyed by his predecessors in the job. The secret police chiefs always had the greatest sexual license. Only Smersh watched Berrier. Otherwise he could do whatever he wanted. He was a sexual predator who used his power to indulge himself in obsessive depravity. Some of the women he seduced went to him to plead for loved ones. Others he simply kidnapped and raped. Yet mothers often pimped their daughters in return for limousines and privileges. Berrier himself could also be a gentleman, treating some mistresses so kindly that they never criticized him, even when he had been exposed as a Soviet bluebeard. He was a familiar sight in Moscow as he cruised the streets in his armored Packard and sent his Caucasian bodyguards, Colonel Sakisov and Nadaraya, to procure women for him. They were usually taken to the townhouse where a Georgian feast and wine awaited them, in a caricature of Caucasian chivalry. One of the colonels always proffered a bouquet of flowers on the way home. If the women resisted, they were likely to get arrested. The singer Zoya Fyodorovna was picked up at a time when she was still breastfeeding her baby. She begged Berrier to let her go as her breasts were painful. Berrier was furious. The officer who was taking her home mistakenly handed her a bouquet at the door. When Berrier saw, he shouted, "It's a wreath, not a bouquet. May they rot on your grave." She was arrested afterwards. Some mistresses inconveniently became pregnant. Once again, the colonels were called upon to arrange abortions or, when a child was born, its place in an orphanage. Berrier was also notorious amongst the magnates themselves. Stalin himself tolerated Beria's priapism when, during the war, Berrier was running half the economy. "Comrade Berrier is tired and overworked." But the less he trusted Berrier, the less tolerant he became. Once, hearing that Svetlana was at Beria's house, Stalin panicked, rang and told her to leave at once. "I don't trust Berrier." Whether this referred to his sexuality or to his politics is not clear. When Berrier told Paskryobyshev that his daughter was as pretty as her mother, the chef de cabinet told her, "Never accept a lift from Berrier." Nina never believed the scale of his exploits. When would Lavrenty have found time to make these hordes of women his mistresses? He spent all day and night at work, so she presumed these women must have been his secret agents.
Sergei Berrier, now 21, had been at school with Svetlana Stalin, Marta Pieskova, and most of the elite children. Like most of the other leaders, Berrier was determined that his son should not go into politics, but encouraged him to become a scientist. He rose to prominence in military technology. But Sergei had grown up around Stalin, and Berrier therefore could not prevent the Generalissimo inviting the young man to the wartime conferences. Sergei was intelligent, cultured, and according to Marta Pieskova, Svetlana Stalin's best friend, so beautifully handsome that he was like a dream. All the girls were in love with him. In 1944, Svetlana fell for him too, and wanted to marry him, an ambition she never gave up even when he himself married someone else. After the Kapler affair, this crush worried the Berriers. "Don't you realize what you're doing?" Nina told Svetlana. "If your father finds out about this, he'll skin Sergei alive." Stalin wanted her to marry one of his potentate's sons, but this honor appalled Berrier, who told his son that Stalin would actually interpret this as an attempt to worm your way into his family. The Berriers put a firm stop to it. Worse was to follow. Marta Pieskova fell in love with Sergei, whom she married soon afterwards. Berrier told Sergei that Stalin would not approve of his connection with the Gorkys. Sure enough, Stalin invited Sergo to Kuntsevo. "Don't fall under your wife's influence," warned Stalin, always suspicious of wives.
"But she's quite non-political," answered Sergo.
"I know, but I regard this marriage as a disloyal act on your part, not to me, but to the Soviet state.
Was it forced on you by your father?"
He accused Beria of making connections with the oppositionist intelligentsia. Then he smiled at Sergo. "Don't take any notice. Old people are always peevish. As for Marfochka, I saw her grow up." Marta moved into the Beria's dacha, where she got to know and love the most infamous man of his time. Beria could not have been kinder to her.
"I was very fond of him. He was very cheerful and very funny, always singing the Mexican song La Paloma and telling comical anecdotes of his life,
such as how he lost his virginity in Romania, getting entangled in the woman's voluminous pantaloons." When Marta gave Beria his first grandchild, he couldn't have been sweeter, spending hours sitting by the cradle just looking at her. In the morning, he'd have the baby brought into his and Nina's room, where he'd sit her between them and just smile at her. He was so indulgent of the child that he let her put her whole hands into her birthday cakes. Marta was less keen on Nina. Her mother-in-law turned out to be as despotic in the house as her father-in-law was outside it. Marta wanted a separate home for her family, but Nina told her, "If you mention that again, you'll find yourself very far from your children." Beria, says Marta, was the cleverest person around Stalin. If he'd been born in America, he would have risen to become something like chairman of General Motors. She was sure he was never a real communist. He once amazed her when he was playing with his granddaughter. "This girl," he said, "will be tutored at home, and then she's going to Oxford University." No other Politburo member would have said such a thing.